Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Last week, researchers at UCSF published a study showing that a ban on sugary drinks at work has significant positive health effects, from smaller waist size to improved insulin resistance to lower cholesterol. Sugar has been targeted by scientists for a while now who view it as an addictive substance that contributes to many of our modern health challenges. Certainly, the evidence suggests that sugar might be making us sick. According to the Centers for Disease Control, 40% of American adults are now clinically obese. 10% of adults have diabetes. Additionally, 34% of adults are what is called pre-diabetic, with blood sugar levels that are abnormally high. Beyond diabetes, sugar has been linked to heart disease, cancer, dementia, and early death. These rates of poor health are big contributors to rising healthcare costs in the U.S. What do the results of this study tell us about how we might reverse this alarming trend? Could a ban on sugary drinks help companies reduce healthcare costs? Does a ban on the sale of sugary drinks infringe on workers' rights? Does this study bolster the argument for the soda tax and other government policies? And what does sugar and smoking have to do with each other? Let's find out more from three of the researchers on this study that was published last week. First, we welcome Alyssa Eppel. She is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSF and is also the director of the Aging Metabolism and Emotions Center and the Consortium for Obesity Assessment, Study, and Treatment, as well as the associate director of the Center for Health and Community. Welcome, Alyssa.
Thank you, Joseph. So happy to be here.
We're also joined by Laura Schmidt, professor of health policy at UCSF. She holds a joint appointment in the Philip R. Lee Institute for Health Policy Studies and the Department of Anthropology, History, and Social Medicine. She's also co-director of the Community Engagement and Health Policy Program for UCSF's Clinical and Translational Sciences Institute. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks, Joseph.
And finally, we're joined by Kimber Stanhope. She's a research nutritional biologist in the Department of Molecular Biosciences at UC Davis. Her work focuses on investigating the effects of sugar consumption on the development of metabolic disease, utilizing well-controlled diet intervention studies in human subjects. Welcome, Kimber.
Nice to be here. Thank you, Joseph.
And of course, we welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll invite you to call in about 20 minutes, but I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send along your questions and comments at any time by emailing us at cityvisions@kalw. So, Alyssa Eppel, I wanted to start with you. Why don't you go ahead and describe in broad strokes what this study was about and what you found?
There is a group of us at UCSF who study obesity and public health, and sugar just pops out as one of the most causative or toxic substances in terms of metabolic disease. And so one of my colleagues sitting next to me, Laura Schmidt, approached me and said, you know, we can't go on like this as a health institution, training doctors and treating patients and serving them soda. And so she convinced the administration to eliminate the sales of all sugared beverages from every campus and hospital at UCSF. And we basically realized we had this phenomenal opportunity to ask the question of whether this will really help people or not. Because a sales ban means they can bring soda to work or sugared beverages, they can have them at home. Would this really make a difference?
And so how did you design your study and what did it show?
So we jumped in to full study mode with lots of support from our colleagues in the administration at UCSF, because everyone is really wanting to know, is this an answer? Is this worth doing? There's lots of hospitals who have a sales ban. None have evaluated it. So we focused on those who were drinking at least a can or one drink a day of a sugary beverage. We asked them if they would be interested in joining a study where we took their blood, we assessed how much they were drinking, and then we followed them over the year. And we had tremendous enthusiastic participation because we educated our campus about sugar and that this sales ban was going to happen. And so we were able to then ask the question of, well, just taking away the sales during the day help people drink less? Does it improve their metabolic health? And then Laura and I bantered back and forth because she's a public policy researcher, and she was saying, this is all we need to do. It's an environmental intervention, and I'm a psychologist. I treat people in my past with eating disorders, with binge eating, with food addiction. And so I was looking at her, shaking my head, saying, no, 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 no. We need to do much more. We need to also talk to people and help them change and not just take away the sales, but enhance their motivation to change. So we compromised with this great study design where half the people were randomized to get this brief counseling intervention. So we could see, did that help? Was that necessary?
Okay, so let's hear the results, because I think everyone wants to know what happens when you remove sugary beverages from the workplace. So go ahead and run through those for us.
So what we found was by 6 months, people had reduced the ounces of sugary beverages by almost 50%, and that stayed a year later. In terms of their body size, we had predicted that we might not see a change in weight on the scale, but we would see a change in waist. And that's because the fat we carry around our abdomen is especially sensitive to sugar. So what we found completely supported that. We found a reduction in waist size. We found that the more they reduced their drinking, the more they improved their metabolic health. Their cholesterol and other lipids went down.
And this was how many people were in the study at this point?
We studied 214 people.
Okay. And then the campus itself employs how many people?
About 30,000.
About 30,000. Okay. So this is a small proportion of the people who were exposed, so to speak, to this change in their work environment. And yet you were able to find something that was statistically significant.
Mm-hmm.
And this was over a period of
about 10 months.
10 months.
Mm-hmm. So to put that in perspective,
yeah.
On average, when folks lost waist girth, it was by almost an inch. And that's only in 10 months.
And so were you surprised by these findings?
Well, especially because for Americans, the trend over time in a year is to gain waist size and to gain weight. And so we were limited in that we couldn't compare our sales band to a different hospital, but we expected people to gain. We found that that people did not gain on average, that they lost waist girth. And then those who did get randomized to the brief counseling intervention, they showed dramatically improved outcomes. So they reduced the amount that they were drinking by 70%.
And how about the change in their waist size and their other
markers? Everyone changed in their waist size. So that was across lean people, people who are overweight. That was a pretty robust finding.
Mm-hmm. So did the people who got the intervention, the behavioral intervention, did they lose more waist size or?
So among there was a trend that for the overweight and obese, they did tend to lose more if they got the intervention. And when we compare them to the overweight people who didn't get the intervention, they had significant improvements in their lipids, cholesterol, ApoB, reductions in LDL, increases in HDL. So we really saw a pattern that really was very encouraging, that an extra nudge, this kind of motivational intervention, and it was only a 10-minute conversation, that this is really making a big difference for people who are heavy drinkers.
So I want to bring Kimber into the conversation, because you design studies all the time, and you were part of this process. What do you make of the way this study was designed? Obviously, you're biased because you're an author on the study, but tell me, when you think about interventions and how hard it is to study nutritional changes and their effects and to tease apart all of the confounding factors, what do you make of the way this study was designed and the simplicity, so to speak, of the intervention?
It's so exciting to see results in the real world. And so, as I already said, this was such a phenomenal opportunity. One variable, take away the soda from the workplace, then plus the extra variable, a little extra motivational speech. That was all they tested, and that was enough to get significant results. Now, on my studies where I provide subjects breakfast, lunch, dinner, the beverages, and beg them, hope they're complying with the rules, they don't eat anything except what I provide, we get far more significant results, but those aren't real-world results. They're so important, though, to documenting the point that you add this much sugar, you see increased risk factors. There is relevant studies where you take away the sugar and provide the diet, you see huge changes. In fact, one study saw incredible changes in teenagers in only 9 days. Far stronger changes than what they saw, but these aren't real world. We'll never have a situation where we're going to provide everybody low sugar breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So we need both. We need my studies and we need their studies.
So you're the sort of the proof of concept and they're the, can this actually work in the real world?
Yes.
So I'm curious. I have tons of questions about who it was that participated in your study. Did you have a sense of when you look at the entire workforce, who got attracted to participate in the study?
This is Laura. There's a problem with our junk food-laden food environment. And a few minutes ago, you asked, did this surprise us? And to be honest, I wasn't surprised because everybody in the obesity prevention world, in the diabetes prevention world, knows that if we can clean up our food environments, if we can nudge ourselves away from the unhealthy stuff and opt for the healthy stuff, we will be in a better situation. I mean, today we are bombarded by marketing messages, by junk food advertisements. You just walk down the cereal aisle in the grocery store and you see it everywhere you look, cartoon characters, bright colors. Everything is beckoning us to eat unhealthy foods. And that's why 70.3% of us are overweight or obese. It's the majority of Americans, and it's about the environment. And so a basic public health strategy, whether it's tobacco, alcohol, junk food, is to clean up the environment. And when people are living in a less saturated environment, they get better. And I think that's what we're seeing here. It is the real world that we're changing, and we need to do more of it.
And did you take a page from the smoke-free campuses that have been perpetuating across at least the Bay Area and perhaps the country? Did you see the link there as well in how you made the argument to the leadership at the university?
What's so cool about UCSF is that our tobacco center was at the forefront of the biggest public health success story of the 20th century, the dramatic decline in smoking. And we learn our lessons really quickly when you're in an environment where people know how to change environments and make people healthier. And so absolutely, that was nobody had studied this before. But it made perfect sense from what we know about alcohol and tobacco that it would work. And I actually think that the next forefront might be the equivalent of secondhand smoke in the workplace, which is secondhand junk food, right? So if you're a kid, you have a big birthday party and you buy one of those horrible Safeway cakes, it's all different colors and all, and then you don't want to leave it in your fridge because you might eat it, right? And so you bring it in and you put it in the break room, right? And so we have to remember that health is a collective good. It's not, we've all been taught that it's all about up to me, individual responsibility, but it's not. It's a collective thing. I'm influenced by what you eat and vice versa. And if we can work together to make our environments more supportive of our health, I think we're moving in the right direction.
And I want to ask one more question about the original intervention, which was to get rid of the sugary beverages on campus. Why the ban on the sales as opposed to just making sure that there was enough other options that were healthier? Why have to go to that extreme? And some of this is policy and some of this is psychology. So I'll have each of you in turn answer that.
So we did roll out water bottle filling stations and promoted with vendors who all did it voluntarily. You're talking mom and pop, stores, food trucks, cafeteria meals, hospital meals. UCSF took it out of everywhere. And in that process, they promoted healthier alternatives. So our vendors who did this voluntarily got a list of over 100 things that are available, unsweetened teas and different kinds of waters that you can sell instead of sugar-sweetened beverages. And so it's very important to always be thinking about the healthy substitute that you want to steer people towards as you're taking the addictive, potentially addictive, unhealthy stuff out of the environment.
And so, Alyssa, why go the extreme to say you're going to take it out of the environment as opposed to, again, enhancing the healthier options?
Well, let me ask you this. Do you have a habit that you wish you didn't do? It was your intention not to do it, and you still do. We all have that. So we have this illusion of personal control. And I love the idea that we should have total personal choice and all the options in front of us. The data is devastating that that doesn't work and that we absolutely need to build a healthy environment without addictive substances. We know that with addiction, and now we know that with sugar and junk food. And so it is, it's a wonderful ideology, this of personal responsibility. And the fact is it's a public health disaster. We must both improve the environment as well as support people in their goals. So our intervention was very interesting. We know that just telling people that sugar is bad for them doesn't work. And people are very tired of thinking that they can, change the weight on the scale. So what we did was showed them visually how many sugar cubes they were drinking a day, and that was actually going to their liver. And even if they weren't overweight and concerned about appearance, it was filling up their liver with fat and it was ruining their metabolism, and that they were on a path to diabetes and other early disease. And in fact, our whole sample on average was pre-diabetic. When we look at the amount of insulin and glucose they have and how well controlled it was poorly controlled, whether they were lean or not. So that's what happens when you're drinking at least one drink a day. So it is, we know that when you have these substances regularly, it is a very deeply ingrained habit, and when you stop, you feel bad. So you're seeking the substance to relieve that dysphoria. It's not that you want to feel high, it's that you feel bad without it.
So you're using terms that are usually used to talk about substance use disorders. And this idea that sugar is addictive has been already mentioned here. Is this a colloquial way of describing sugar's effect on people? Or are we
not
talking about science that shows that sugar is truly addictive?
We now have at least a decade of good science that actually shows in animal models that sugar rewires the brain's reward system and is addictive. So rats who then get junk food, when you take it away, they then binge on it when they get it again. And then they go through withdrawal when you take it away. They show the signs of addiction. And Bart Hobel, the first addiction researcher who started looking at sugar, was so alarmed when he saw that it was an addictive substance. And he tried as hard as he could before he died to show that. And his students are carrying on that work. And it's remarkable.
And I want to go back now to the study participants. You said a lot of them were pre-diabetic. Did you notice that a certain part of the employee group at UCSF tended to be overrepresented in your sample of study participants? And I'm seeing some shaking, nodding heads there from Laura. Who were they?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a problem that really disproportionately affects lower-income people. And at UCSF, that includes our employees and coworkers who are manual or service workers. And so what we saw was that And it's probably driven by income and availability, the ability to, afford healthier alternatives. Fruits and vegetables are more expensive than junk food. And so that's who wound up kind of gravitating towards our study, the people who were eligible. The doctors working in the hospitals and the academics like us were drinking maybe on average about 4 ounces a day of sugar-sweetened beverages, which is not a real big risk. But the folks in the manual and service professions were drinking more like 25 ounces a day.
Did you reach out to them specifically to participate, or they seemed to come to you in larger proportion?
So we screened the 3,000 people on our campus to assess how much they're drinking. So we have a larger survey study. And from that, we invited the first several hundred people who were drinking heavily, several drinks a day, to be in our sub-study.
Okay. So it was those who were drinking more that got invited to the sub study, and so what was the reaction like when people? I'm assuming you shared your results with them in the sense of their personal results. What was their reaction like when they saw after 6, 10, 12 months that in fact decreasing their sugary beverage intake made a difference?
We found that remarkably, there were very positive attitudes about the sales ban in the first place because of the education, because they felt like their workplace cared about them. And even the cafeteria workers who had an open tap and could have as much soda they wanted all day, they ended up benefiting the most from the study. So when we asked them how much they were drinking at home, they actually were reducing equally at home and at work. So this wasn't just a mindless, unconscious behavior that they couldn't grab a Coke. They actually were changing their health behaviors. They were aware. They knew they could do it. And there's a question we asked them that we think was very important. So those who had the motivational discussion, we asked them, do they want to reduce and why? And the why is really much deeper than, well, people tell me I should or I want to lose weight. But we really probed to what their deepest reason was that they should care about themselves. Often it was that they cared about their grandchildren, wanting to see them graduate high school, and they didn't want to get diabetes like a relative. So they ended up not being superficial reasons like weight, but really caring for oneself and letting themselves, take the time and make a goal that would be good for their purpose in life.
And I know that that Kimber, we spoke very early on about the fact that the elegant design of the one factor that's changed. Did you look into whether people made other changes in their diets or their health behaviors because they were paying more attention to it? And could you contribute any of the changes you saw to those?
In this study, we didn't have a lot of opportunity to do that, but we're currently conducting a larger study. We've randomized 8 hospitals, 4 in all in the Sutter Health Plan, which is here in California, 8 hospitals, 4 of which get the intervention and 4 don't, and we're tracking employees in there. We're looking at their whole diets and a lot of different factors. Stress is often a big driver for consuming these products and getting hooked on them. So we have a lot ahead of us.
And when you say randomized, do you mean to the ban of sugary
yes.
beverages? So 4 campuses are going to continue to sell them and 4 campuses
right.
won't. Wow.
And what's funny is a lot of the campuses that got our controls can't wait to do it as soon as the study ends.
I see. Well, let me take a moment to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're talking with researchers from UCSF and UC Davis about a recent study that shows the health benefits from banning sales of sugary beverages at work. And in this example, it's UCSF. We have Alyssa Eppel, professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSF, Laura Schmidt, professor of health policy there, and Kimber Stanhope, research nutritional biologist in the Department of Molecular Biosciences at UC Davis. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. Do you think your workplace should ban the sale of sugary drinks? And what do you think should be done about the high rate of sugar consumption in our country? Join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at cityvisions@klw.org. Post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at CityVisions KALW. So, Kimber Stanhope, I wanted to go back to you because Alyssa mentioned how sugar is an addictive substance that leads to this cascade of all these health effects that we've been talking about. When you think of nutritional substances or compounds, I don't know if you call them nutritional, but such as sugar, salt, fat, when you look at them together, how do you understand the differences in terms of their ill effects on our health? Because, you know, the concerns about sugar have been around for a while, but for a long time it was fat that was of concern. So how do you square all of those things? And does sugar stand out more than the others?
Sugar definitely stands out, but interestingly, there's a very important paper just published by a very important researcher showing sugar, you put it together with fat, ouch, it's even worse. Yes. So that was done in mice. We haven't done it in humans yet, but I have long thought that we're just scratching the surface when we talk about the sugar-sweetened beverages. When I design my studies and I give subjects the sugar-sweetened beverage to drink along with their meal, my meal has a salad that's 6 inches on a 6-inch plate. But most people aren't necessarily drinking their sugar-sweetened beverage with the salad. They're drinking it with fries and hamburgers that might even have bacon and double cheese. And it's scary when you put those together in combination, because one of the things we know sugar does, it revs up fat making in the liver, but at the very same time, it's clamping down on fat burning in the liver. So what's happening to all that fat from the hamburger and the French fries when you've clamped down on the fat burning? So when we act like, oh, we've learned that it's sugar is bad and fat's no problem, I don't necessarily think we've learned that. We have a long ways to go. Olives and almonds and nuts, are those healthy foods? Yes. And so the fat phobia times we went through in the 70s, early 80s, yes, we were on the wrong track. But does that suddenly make fast food meals healthy? And because if you just don't have the sugar sweetened beverage, you're okay?
Right.
I don't think so.
You know, branded burger plus the Diet Coke on the side.
Right.
So when you're talking about fat, are you making distinctions between animal fat and plant fats?
In general, that's the easiest distinction to make. However, coconut is a plant fat, and it is one of the highest sources of saturated fat. And I've seen study results that does not make plant fat from coconut look too good. So probably that is not completely solid yet as to are all plant fats okay and all animal fats something to be concerned at. There's certainly data that suggests dairy fat is probably protective. So any attempt to divide it animal versus plant, dairy is definitely making that difficult.
Right. So it's not that simple, although the focus on sugar seems very, very simple. I'm curious, why weren't fruit juices banned? That's pretty concentrated sugar right there. It's not added sugar, but Can you say more there?
Yeah. So when you're setting a policy, you really need to feel very secure in the evidence base. You need, and we have a strong evidence base around sugar, and particularly sugar-sweetened beverages. They really have no health benefits. They're the low-hanging fruit in the world of nutrition reform. But fruit juices are different. There's a thinner evidence base around whether they are harmful to health. And our own Kimber Stanhope is conducting really the first study that pits sugar-sweetened beverages against fruit juice.
Say more about that.
And it is under one of those controlled environment studies. So we're providing breakfast, lunch, dinner, orange juice, or sugar-sweetened beverage to subjects for 6 weeks. And we're doing metabolic and mechanistic. We're actually even doing the testing to see if there's fat revving caused by orange juice. We know it's going to happen with the sugar-sweetened beverage. We've already proven it. But are we going to see sugar-sweetened beverage? They have equal amount of sugar. They're very similar, but the number of other things in the orange juice is huge. Is one of those other things, bioactive, polyphenols, able to somehow attenuate all the bad things that a liver can do with sugar? We don't know yet. And this will be the first study to ask that. We're only in our second year, so we have 3 more years of study to do before we'll have answers. But it's a very interesting question, and the fact that we do not have a good answer is reflected in the dietary guidelines from the United States versus the dietary guidelines from the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization says you should not consume more than 10% of your calories as free sugar. But their definition of free sugar includes fruit juice, 100% fruit juice. So they're saying it needs to be monitored and counted toward that limit of 10%. U.S. dietary guidelines, we say do not consume more than 10% of your daily calories as added sugar. Mm. Added sugar does not include the sugar from fruit juice. So our poor consumers, they can go to the experts, the guidelines, mm-hmm. yep. and get 2 different answers. That's how badly the study needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of calls I want to get to. So I want to put the phone number out first. This is City Visions on KLW San Francisco 91.7 and FM and KLW.org. As we talk about the simple experiment that was done at UCSF to ban the sale of sugar-sweetened beverages and the impact, positive impact it had on markers of obesity and other metabolic problems, and whether this could be a next phase in the way that we try to address the epidemics of obesity in our country and diabetes by changing the food environment in which we work, since we spent so much of our days there. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Let's go to George from San Francisco. George, welcome to the program.
Thanks. While we're at it, we were thinking, if we're going to study the effects of sugar or its absence, is there any parallel study, or do you know of any research that's been done that might correlate other constituents like genetically manufactured foodstuffs that wind up in our sweet drinks? Do you know whether there's any study that correlates that?
All right. Thanks, George, for your call. Any answers there?
I don't think so. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about GMOs. And certainly not at the kind of level of precision that some of these studies are being conducted, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Ariana from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to thank the doctors for this study. And it it really needs to lead us to Iowa, where there's so much that the farm industry has control over our diets in terms of subsidized corn syrup. And I think this creates a problem because people generally dismiss obese people in this country, a Calvinistic country, that defames desires, yet also believes that those who have more, that have satiated their desires, are, you know, the elect of God, basically people of power and money and beauty. That's an original idea from this country. And so you see, in a very materialistic country, you see that people gain weight, but they have a sense of emptiness, and then we tend to condemn them. And I think also that it's a spiritual problem in the sense that, you know, when people really taste their food and take the time to sit down and feel what it feels like after they eat a meal, they can get a sense that a lot of the food that satisfies maybe their tongue before they've really developed or educated their palate, or before they have the privilege and the money to buy better food, that a lot of that kind of food doesn't make one feel good. And one can see that kind of you know, degenerative food stuff, that impacts one's ability to live an adult life fully. And they've even done studies in prisons where if they improve the food, like even offer them a vegetarian diet that has more good food or vitamins, that there's a decrease in violence. So this is a really layered issue about privilege and about education and about our government that allows foodstuffs and corporations that have like bliss points and unlisted ingredients in our food that people just sort of blithely buy, assuming it's a safe at the grocery store. So thank you, your guest.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your call, Ariana. Alyssa Eppel, this makes me want to turn to you because you're the director of the Aging, Metabolism, and Emotions Center.
Right.
This is where it all comes together.
Right. Ariana,
and Ariana tipped us in that
direction. I was
nodding
and nodding. Yeah. You've made so many good points, and you're absolutely right. This is a very multi-layered, multifactorial problem, and there are big forces at work that are hijacking our reward center. I like to think that, you know, once we develop every extra fat cell, all these adipocytes we develop, the big food is making more money. And there's this correlation between that, because the more we gain, the more we have insulin, and the more we're craving and wanting and vulnerable to giving into all of these unhealthy products. So I want to comment on some of what you said about food and mood. And there is an emerging, very strong science showing that on a population level, the traditional American diet is linked to anxiety, stress, and depression. This is in 7 different countries. We've shown this. Now, different researchers have shown this. And now there are even trials showing that if you take people with depression and you switch them from their typical American diet to a Mediterranean diet, we get 30% remission of depression. There's not one drug study that you can show me that leads to that much relief. So it may not be the initial cause of depression, but boy, we can really improve our brain chemistry with a whole foods diet.
And staying with, and I'm not sure which of you want us to weigh in here, but in terms of a food culture, if that's even a term we can use in this country, of are we unique in terms of how food and emotions get sort of conflated, or using food as a way to deal with emotions, or is this kind of a human thing?
No, that's I'll take that. We all do that. We are naturally wired that when we feel emotional, we crave comfort food, typically high fat mixed with salt or sugar. And so it turns out that our body metabolizes calories differently when we're stressed. And the combination of having a lot of stress hormones and eating comfort food or junk food causes our body shape to be more of that apple shape. It causes us to deposit fat at the abdomen. We know this in rats. We know this in people.
But I would add that the food corporations know it better than anybody else. Michael Moss's book showed how They literally put people in an MRI machine, a functional MRI, the kind of machine that Alyson and colleagues use to measure brain chemicals and brain activity, and feed them Dorito chips to make the recipe the most addictive and the most to trigger that craving. And so we're really fighting against a very large machine here that is driving us towards an obesity epidemic, and they've succeeded.
And Laura, this is Kimber. I have a very unproven observation, but when you talk about the MRIs and how they're looking at the reward reactions when they show people the pictures of the foods and so on, I'm sitting there thinking, our advertisements for food are getting more and more focused on these huge pictures of the hamburger. You know, we used to have the sexy girl eating the hamburger. Remember that? But now they're not so much that, as they're just showing huge foods. And I'm wondering if it's because of I've done these functional MRI studies showing, bing, when people see pictures of foods.
You lobbied successfully, Laura, for banning the sale of sugar-sweetened beverages. Why not other sugary foods like donuts or cookies or cakes or pies or muffins? I made a long list here. Are those not as clearly linked to what we've been talking about? Is that harder? Is it just like you're pushing too hard now? Why stop at sugar-sweetened beverages?
Well, like I said before, they're the low-hanging fruit in terms of cleaning up our food environment. It's the equivalent of the sort of carbon problem with climate. It's all around us. It's everywhere. It's being pushed on us. And if we can just deal with that, we're obviously, on the basis of this study, we're really moving our health in the right direction. The industry comes back frequently, especially when we're fighting around soda taxes, and they'll say, well, you know, why pick on us? And I have to ask the question, what is, you know, if you just pull apart what's in a soda, it's a bunch of water, it's a bunch of sugar, it's an addictive agent, namely caffeine, and a bunch of artificial colors and flavors. That's it. You can modify the colors and flavors, the amount of sugar, the amount of caffeine, to get a different kind of soda. But it's the same basic thing. And so there's just very little to commend this particular product. And if you can show me a product that is as addictive, habit-forming, as well as equally poor for nutritional in terms of nutritional value, yeah, let's take a look at it.
I have, this is Kimber, tried several times to get money from NIH to do the sugar-sweetened beverage versus the solid sugar study. And never have gotten it funded. It really frustrates me because I think it's incredibly important that we do this work. So my next grant's going in again, February. I'm trying again, and maybe this time I'll be luckier. But I do want to say there is a evidence reason for going after the sugar-sweetened beverage. All the epidemiology data has been really strong for sugar and not so strong for solid sugar. Now, there might be a reason for that. A lot of epidemiology data is based on questionnaires. How much sugar-sweetened beverage did you consume last week is actually an easier question to answer than how much sugar in other foods did you consume last week. Much harder to remember, and of course they're not going to count the ketchup or the salad dressing or the teriyaki sauce and all the other things that don't register as sugar-containing desserts. So that might be one of the reasons solid sugar isn't coming up as strong as a risk factor for cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes as the sugar-sweetened beverage.
You also have to look at how it's consumed as recommended. So it's really easy to down a very large amount of sugar in a very short amount of time on an empty stomach and just deliver your liver and pancreas a big old wallop of sugar, and it won't even make you full, right? Yeah. And you don't even have to chew it. And so it's just going to deliver that blast to your organs in a very fast way. And, of course, it's the ideal delivery vehicle for sugar in that way. If you look at, and on top of it, the norms have changed so much. If you look at the size of a Coke bottle in the 1950s, it was like 6 ounces, right? Nobody drinks that these days. You go into the 7-Eleven, you buy a liter, you sit it in the car next to you, and you drink out of it all day. Very, very different kind of habit forming. And of course, the industry's pushing this. The sizes get bigger and bigger with every generation.
I just want to add the brain as another organ. That liquid sugar hits very quickly. And we know that's partly why it's so addictive. So, for example, if you have, cocaine, if you snort cocaine, you'll get an effect, a peak effect, 10 minutes later. It's pretty quick. If you smoke crack, 2 minutes later. Crack is tremendously more addictive. Liquid sugar is the analog to that. It's gonna hit our reward system very quickly.
Once again, I want to put the phone number out to join our conversation tonight about banning the sale of sugar-sweetened beverages at work and what the implications could be for the health of our nation. And by doing so, given the research that was just published last week through UCSF that showed some very short time some significant changes in the positive direction of slimmer waistlines and decreased cholesterol and insulin resistance just by banning the sales of sugar sweetened beverages across the UCSF campus sites. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment at the KLW website. So listen, I want to go back for a moment because we've talked a lot about environment. When you think of scaling up something like this, how do you see the motivational interviewing, the behavioral impact, the behavioral intervention, being able to be scaled up? And it's an important question to answer because you did see an additional effect.
And we're thinking exactly along those lines. How do we do that? Our playground is UC, UCOP. We're one of the biggest employers in California. And there's a tremendous interest in helping with the obesity problem. Laura's helping lead that. Now, we have digital platforms that can help. We must have real people behind these interventions. A digital intervention is good for a few weeks and then people don't use anymore. So we're working on how do we implement this across UCs? How can we help those at most risk with support? And this model, you need a PhD and you need training. This is really about us supporting each other and doing this together. And that's, we ask people to go home and talk to who they live with about what they learned and to even watch a video about the effect of sugar on health. And we can't assess that out, like how much did that help? But I think that was why we saw the big reductions at home. So this whole idea, going to work shouldn't impair our health because it's stressful and because we're surrounded by, food that we shouldn't be eating. It should enhance our health. So it's on all of us to think about our workplaces, our schools, our institutions, and can we agree together to make them safe and supportive environments for both our physical health and our mental health.
Did you find out when the people, obviously people did not, well, maybe some people stopped drinking sugar-sweetened beverages, but on average about 50% reduction. Where did they get their sugar-sweetened beverages? Did they go off campus on their break, or was this all at home and weekend consumption? Do you know?
That's a good question. It's probably a little bit of each. So, in our next study, in our Sutter study, and we have plans after that as well, we'll really understand the behaviors better and as well as by talking to people. So we're just amazed that we got a signal from this study, in the messy real world.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Now the question, of course, back to you, Laura, is the scaling up. Where does this go from here in terms of policy? Is this going to be a more feasible way to address this than, let's say, sugar taxes and other ways that government has been trying to address this up until now? Or is it just one other way of doing this?
Well, it took us a long time to get here with incremental changes in our food environment. I mentioned the size of a Coke in 1950 versus today. And so we incrementally were brought into this situation with our food environment, and that's the way to get out of it. The model for the tobacco tells us that. At a certain point, people get the message. They learn that in the case of the tobacco episode in the later 20th century, people started to see that it's not nice to smoke at work, and now you're standing outside the building. And over time, you get to the point where the people left who do smoke want to quit, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's a combination of changing public policy, but also changing norms and changing people's attitudes and beliefs. And the other thing is showing that it can work. This is a totally new kind of novel intervention. It's wonderful that it appears to be working at UCSF. And what's pretty cool is that when people at the office of the president for the whole university caught wind of our findings, they said, hey, let's try to scale this up across all 10 campuses. The UCs are, I think, the third largest employer in California. We could make a big dent in this state if we could leverage the power and the knowledge and the expertise of the UC system to drive down sugar-sweetened beverage consumption and promote water consumption and environmentally sustainable alternative. And so that's what we're working on now. If we can show that we can scale it in our own backyard, then that's going to send a message to a lot of other organizations. You asked the question around soda taxes. And what happened in California last year was that we had several local governments that decided to tax sugar-sweetened beverages. Four of them were in the Bay Area here. And God forbid we start doing that, and wonderful scientists like Chris Madsen at Berkeley might go in and demonstrate, as she has, that they actually reduce consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages, right? And then you've got a firestorm of cities and counties wanting to tax soda. And so the American Beverage Association came in and cut a deal with folks in our government to do what's called preemption, which means that they basically made it illegal for any city government, any county government in California to pass a soda tax, a new one, for the next 12 years. Now, this is a big blockade. The sugar-sweetened beverage sales ban, nobody can tell an employer what to sell. It's their business. And so it's an alternative that doesn't have these kinds of political roadblocks that industry can put up in front of people who care about health.
Because basically, you could take your business elsewhere as a private entity, and it's not about infringing on people's rights by taxing them, so to speak.
You'd think, you'd hope it would be. But in fact, what we are confronting in our own backyard in the UCs is something called pouring rights contracts.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah. Now, these are very poorly understood. Researchers haven't really gotten into this, but people in my field are currently. Essentially, these are exclusive agreements between big beverage corporations, Pepsi and Coca-Cola, with entities. It might be the University of California, or it might be for paying for sports teams on some of our campuses. So the deal is,
or a movie theater chain, or an airline,
exactly.
Or something.
Mm-hmm. If we co-brand our student athletes with Pepsi, then we'll get some money for our sports teams. You can only imagine the vast sums of money that are to be gained by a beverage corporation co-branding with one of our strong athletic students, you know, you could only imagine what a putting some of our students on the side of a bus with a Pepsi banner in front of them. So this is a practice that is within private organizations, including the university. It's a barrier, but there are a lot of ways around barriers, and that's what we're about.
Yes, Alyssa.
Well, for our listeners, for anyone who's interested in thinking about what they can do in their institution, another thing to think about is the environmental impact. We know that our ban reduced the carbon footprint. We have a professor of environmental studies who's actually calculated that. And so if you think about how many cans and bottles we're consuming each day and how we might change that with spa water, et cetera, that's yet another motivation and probably a bigger one these days than ever.
Hmm. And is there a toolkit that you'll put together at some point for if other people want to replicate what you've done at UCSF?
Yeah, we already have. We're a public university with a public service mission, and so that's what we do. This initiative came out of just people who care about the issue coming together and talking to leadership and leadership listening. And so if you go to sugarscience.org, one word, sugar science, you will see a toolkit for how to pull off a healthy beverage initiative in your own workplace. And many of the people who have used the toolkit are just concerned employees in their workplace who just want to leverage their knowledge and their position in their own work environment to make change happen all around them.
So that one more time, that was?
sugarscience.org.
And we'll link that to our website as well, so people can listen to the show and then click on the link. So we're almost out of time here. What last things do you want to say to people listening out there who might be wondering, okay, great, I do this in my workplace. How do I do this in my home life? How do I get other people around me to feel the same way?
Yes.
Thoughts, practical tips.
Big yes. That's what we need to do. And so this is really hard. This is something that people feel shame and guilt about, and that makes it even harder. And so we've got to get rid of this as a personal issue. This is not about us. This is about the food environment. And the only way we can tackle that is together, is to having shared agreements in our homes, in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods, because otherwise we know what happens and we have a public health disaster. And we can turn that around. We can't wait for the government to.
Any organization, and that includes your own family, can pass its own healthy beverage initiative. You can take the sugar-sweetened beverages out of the fridge. You can put the water on the table. And you can control your own food environment at home. And we have to start thinking about taking care of our own food environments as a strategy. That's the way that our employees benefited. And anyone can do that at any level.
And Kimber, last word.
I'm the one that has looked at columns and columns of data showing the risk factors go up with the sugar consumption. So you would think I would have the most perfect iron will in the world. And I do, as long as I have sugar out of my house. However, somebody brings the box of chocolate into my house and it stays there. Yes, all of a sudden that iron will is not there. Even though I'm the one that sat there and stared at the data and I'm the one that's going around talking about sugar being a problem. So I can't tell you what an important tool to start getting it out of the house is.
Very
to make
good.
A big difference.
Out of the work site, out of the house. out, damn sugar.
Yes.
And that's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Alyssa Epple, a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSF, Laura Schmidt, professor of health policy at UCSF, and Kimber Stanhope, research nutritional biologist in the Department of Molecular Biosciences at UC Davis. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you so much.
It's our pleasure. Thank you, Joseph.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb with in-studio help by Kendra Klang. We'll be off next Monday. Join us live again in 2 weeks. This is Joseph Pache from all of us here at City Visions. Thanks for listening. Good night.